This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. The World Health Organization warned that vaccines were no magic bullet for the coronavirus crisis as Russia started vaccinating its high-risk workers on Saturday. Health officials in Moscow said they had opened 70 coronavirus vaccine centers in the Russian capital that would initially offer shots for health, education, and social workers. But the WHO is warning about what it says is a wrong belief that the COVID-19 crisis is over, with shots on the horizon nearly a year after the start of the pandemic. Vaccines do not equal zero COVID, said WHO Emergencies Director Michael Ryan, adding that not everyone will be able to receive it early next year. The comments came as the United States clocked a record number of COVID-19 cases for a second day in a row on Friday, with the country preparing for what U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has called a dark winter. America's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended universal face mask use indoors, and Biden said he would scale down his January inauguration ceremony to mitigate the virus risk. The WHO says 51 candidate vaccines are currently being tested on humans, with 13 reaching final stage mass testing. Britain on Wednesday became the first Western country to approve an inoculation. This one is from Pfizer-BioNTech. It's for general use, and of course, it's putting pressure on other countries to follow. The United States is expected to greenlight a program later this month, and Belgium, France, and Spain have said vaccines will begin in January for the most vulnerable. More than 66 million people have contracted COVID-19 globally, with the death toll from the disease topping 1.5 million. This is VOA News. Turkey has entered its first full weekend lockdown since May after coronavirus infections and deaths hit record highs in recent days. The country of 83 million people on Friday recorded over 32,700 new cases, including asymptomatic ones, the highest number since the beginning of the pandemic in March. The total death toll rose by 193 on Friday, touching a daily record level seen earlier this week to over 14,500. Turkish television showed largely empty squares and streets on Saturday in the largest city, Istanbul, the capital, Ankara, and the third largest city, Izmir, with only a few people and vehicles out and about. Turkey now ranks fourth globally for the number of daily new cases, behind only the United States, India, and Brazil, all countries with far larger populations than Turkey. In other parts of the world, Kyrgyzstan announces that citizens of all nations will be allowed to enter the Central Asian country, lifting border restrictions it had instituted at the start of the pandemic last spring. The only requirement for entry is a negative test presented before boarding and on arrival, taken within 72 hours. Rio de Janeiro's shopping malls will stay open 24 hours a day through Christmas, authorities have announced, hoping to avoid overcrowding amidst a second wave of coronavirus cases. The move goes against the recommendations of scientists who want new restrictions in the Brazilian city, which is seeing an increase in COVID-19 deaths and infections. Italy is experiencing a sharp resurgence of COVID-19 infections after it largely tamped down an earlier outbreak by enforcing a strict lockdown, while Latin America and the Caribbean region has seen an 18% spike in cases in a week. Other countries are also unveiling holiday restrictions, with Switzerland banning Christmas caroling in the streets and Madrid canceling most New Year's events in the city center. The United States is asking Germany and the EU to halt construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline linking Russia to Europe, which Washington sees as a political tool of the Kremlin. This is what a top envoy said in a German newspaper interview on Saturday. The U.S. acting ambassador to Germany, Robin Quenneville, told a Business Daily that now is the time for Germany and the EU to impose a moratorium on the construction of the pipeline. She added that this would send a strong signal to Russia that Europe was not willing to accept its ongoing malicious behavior. She said the pipeline is a political tool being used to bypass the Ukraine and divide Europe. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Jonathan Broder, Contributing Editor for Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator is Michael Williams, Contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Despite the continuing baseless claims of widespread election fraud by U.S. President Donald Trump, an increasing number of elected officials in the United States and abroad recognized President-elect Joe Biden as the winner of the 2020 election and called for Trump to concede and cease actions that are both divisive and seemingly doomed to fail. President-elect Biden ramped up his transition, naming key staff to his economic and communications teams. The selections highlighted Biden's promise to create an administration of diversity and experience. COVID-19 continued to spike in the United States, and record travel during the recent national holiday has health officials concerned that a devastating wave of hospitalizations and fatalities may follow. Meanwhile, Great Britain became the first country to approve the use of a COVID-19 vaccine, with plans to distribute the vaccine before the end of the year, both with the most vulnerable groups receiving the vaccine as early as next week. And tensions between Israel and Iran heightened in the wake of the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Iran's top nuclear scientist, and the reported deaths of other high-level Iranian military and intelligence officials. Panelists, welcome. As we start with the 2020 election and the continued claims of fraud, I could say persistent and seemingly baseless claims of widespread voter fraud on the 2020 elections by President Donald Trump, a growing number of officials are, including officials in Trump's own Republican Party, are recognizing Joe Biden as the victor, as and using the term president-elect, which seemed to be a very difficult thing to have happen, and called on Trump to cease and desist, as even as some officials are being threatened just for participating in elections. Trump so far has refused, insisting that the election was somehow rigged, even though he has lost virtually every legal appeal and has no proof of this election fraud. Linda, I'll start with you. Going forward, is there any factual basis to President Trump's continuing claims of election fraud?
There's no evidence as yet of widespread election fraud. So every election has irregularities. People vote twice. Dead people vote, and on and on. But what we're looking at here is allegations of widespread fraud. And even Attorney General William Barr came out this week and said there is no such evidence of widespread fraud, or at least so far as any investigations have unearthed. So at this point, this is just Donald Trump, frankly, trying to delay the inevitable and poison the well for the incoming President Joe Biden.
Jonathan, the fraud that we have here, if we're talking about something that's meant to be as widespread as multi-state, maybe even a national election scheme that somehow would overturn millions of votes in just the right places while affecting President Trump, while not affecting those down ballot from him, because as everyone has commented, Senate Republicans and Republicans in the House of Representatives did surprisingly well during the election. My question is, who specifically is being named as responsible for this fraud? Has anyone in particular been named? Anyone in the Democratic Party, an official, elected official, who's being blamed for this?
No one. There is no one person or group of people that are considered responsible. I mean, if Trump has anyone to blame, it would be probably Democratic election officials in the individual states. But there's one other thing that I think people need to realize about this. One of the reasons why Trump is continuing to hammer this issue is because he's raising money off of it. Now, the old expression, follow the money. He has raised so far $170 million, which has gone into a supposed election defense fund to purportedly fund continuing legal efforts to challenge the election results. The truth is that 75 to 80% of this money goes into a super PAC, which Trump can use not only for his personal travel, he can use it for anything.
And again, a super PAC being a election apparatus where money can be basically dumped into a bucket and used for any purpose. that the organizer of that super PAC deems fit. As you say, anything from election costs to legal fees, you name it. Linda, going back to you, and you'd mentioned that William Barr declared the U.S. Justice Department has uncovered no evidence of widespread voter fraud that could have changed the outcome of the election. You have Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia all certifying their election results as fair and accurate, with, in some cases, Biden winning more votes after recounts were done. And yet, 70% of Republicans, by many polls, believe that there was widespread fraud and this election was somehow stolen from Donald Trump. How does the United States resolve that type of discrepancy in its own institutions between virtually one half of the country and another?
It's a huge challenge for President-elect Biden. He's going to need to work really hard to fulfill his promise to be the president of all Americans and not just those who voted for him. These polls that show that the majority of Republicans believe that basically Joe Biden stole the election, I take those very seriously. They represent a potentially toxic schism within American government and politics and American public life. But at the same time, I would caution against reading too much into that. I think at a time of high tension and drama in particular, people tend to think the worst of the candidate they don't support. So for example, when Barack Obama was president, people would be asked, do you think he's a Muslim? Do you think he was born in Kenya? Do you think he's a socialist? And people who opposed Obama all agreed to all of that, even if they might have known deep down it wasn't true. So I think for all these voters who believe that Donald Trump really did win a second term, I would just give them some time to process and relax and think about where we are going forward and how it might be possible to overcome this.
And it's worth noting that President Trump began essentially his serious political career, his current presidential aspirations, with the notion that Barack Obama was not an American somehow. The propagation of that lie began his serious candidacy within the Republican Party. Johnson, going back to you, and you'd mentioned election officials in the states where Trump is claiming that some of the manipulation took place. These people are facing a barrage of abuse and even death threats just for working on the election. These are not political people per se. They are involved in the political process of the election, but they're not political people. An election official in Georgia gave an impassioned plea to President Trump and to Republican senators to denounce the threats, saying, quote, those in positions of leadership need to display leadership. Linda alluded to this earlier. I want to ask you pretty much the same question. Are the baseless claims of fraud more or less harmless political posturing or a dangerous ruse that could really lead to tragic outcomes for individuals and for American democracy?
I think it's the second. I mean, we've seen during the campaign, before the election itself, there was a plot in Michigan by a local militia group, a right-wing militia group, to kidnap and possibly kill the governor of Michigan. I mean, this is extraordinary. Now, these people were uncovered and arrested, but, you know, there are a lot of sort of what they call lone wolves, people who are not on anybody's radar. They're not a part of any white supremacist or militia group. They're just individuals who are inspired by racist ideology, and they all have weapons. This is going to be a problem. It already is a problem, but it's, I fear, going to be a bigger problem for law enforcement.
Well, I think the courts have not yielded any success for Donald Trump's claims. The court of public opinion seems to be turning gradually, and the clock is ticking. Let's move on to the Biden transition. President-elect Joe Biden has formally introduced this past week the officials who will lead his economic and also his communications team. He's poised to take the helm of the federal government as the nation is really grappling with the economic fallout of a health crisis, the coronavirus pandemic. And I will say first that we continually, I guess, covered the transition process, but I think it's important that we do so because of the nature of this transition, both the point in history that it is, and because it's been a transition like no other that I have seen in terms of the difficulty and the non-cooperation. So both the exterior and interior circumstances warrant us from keeping up with this thing. With that said, I'll go to you, Johnson. Who are the key people on the economic team coming in? I would start with Janet Yellen. It's a name that may be familiar to our listeners, but talk a little bit about her and her importance to this team.
There's Janet Yellen, of course. She was the former chairman of the Federal Reserve. She's been nominated to be the next Treasury Secretary, very, very experienced economist, and someone who has sort of created a lot of confidence or optimism in the way that this administration is going to handle the economic situation that the country's in. There's also Neera Tanden, who is currently the head of a progressive or left center-left think tank called the Center for American Progress. She's been chosen to be the to lead the Office of Management and Budget. And she is a bit controversial because many Republicans consider her a bit too partisan for the position. There is Cecilia Rouse to be the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers. I hope I pronounced this right. Adewale Adeyemo as Treasury Secretary. And then Jared Bernstein and Heather Boushey as members of the White House Council of Economic Advisers. Heather Boushey is another one who is controversial. Apparently, there are people at the think tank that she used to run who feel that she is not the greatest manager in the world. So some of these issues are probably going to, are very clearly going to play out during the confirmation hearings.
And before we go to break, and we'll continue this topic after, Linda, your comments on the team coming in, both the economic team and I'm especially interested in your comments on the communications team as Joe Biden has chosen an all-female communications team for his administration.
What's been so striking about Joe Biden's appointment so far is the diversity. As you said, all women running the communications shop, both press secretary, deputy press secretary, communications director, all women. Some are women of color. Some are LGBT. We're also seeing, I think, interestingly, some tension over pressure that Joe Biden faces to appoint people of color to high-profile positions. So he may be on the verge of nominating the first female defense secretary, but others are arguing that it needs to be a Black person. So there's some names being put forth in that regard. In the effort to be diverse, which is, of course, long overdue, nothing's ever completely harmonious and happy in that world.
Yeah, it's very hard to keep all the constituencies happy in either party. We know that for a fact. We'll take a quick break and come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Jonathan Broder, Contributing Editor for Congressional Quarterly. And our moderator, Michael Williams, Contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. As we complete this discussion of the Biden transition, I just wanted to take a look at the criticism that has been leveled at some of the incoming people. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, a Republican senator, alluded to the fact that all of the, or many of the appointments by Joe Biden have been from an Ivy League background and that they were somehow the appeasers to the ideas of globalism, that sort of thing. Very early to take shots at a group that hasn't even faced its first hearing yet. When you hear this sort of criticism, Jonathan, do you feel like, again, it's legitimate concerns on their part or more posturing for upcoming hearings or even towards the 2024 election cycle? I can't even believe we don't even have an inauguration yet for 2020. We're talking about the 2024 election cycle. But is it part of that?
I think it's pure politics. These nominations are a chance for the Republicans. In this case, now they're the, at least in terms of presidential politics, they are the opposition. So they're going to start raising issues that they feel might play politically. So Marco Rubio mentions the elitist Ivy League background of these nominees, and that is in a way a way of energizing the Republican base of people who don't have an Ivy League education or perhaps no college education at all. And we know that from analysis of polling that the people who have been the biggest supporters of the of Trump and of Republicans are white men without a college education. So you can see who Rubio is targeting when he makes a comment like that.
Yeah, it does seem to be purely political, especially since the resumes of the people who've been chosen so far are practically spotless. And the one I'd like to mention before we go forward is Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith. She's a healthcare expert from Yale University, and she's about to become the most famous doctor in the world as she's been chosen by Biden to lead his pandemic task force. Let's move on to the COVID-19 crisis. The world's largest COVID-19 outbreak, it seems like we're saying this weekly, is in the United States. The virus largely hit urban areas first in the U.S. early in the pandemic, but the current surge is now devastating rural America, which has far less resources to deal with the wave of cases and hospitalizations. New estimates are for 400,000 deaths or more before the end of the winter. And those estimates were prior to the Thanksgiving Day travel surge that created the kind of small family gathering that health officials now believe are the most common way the virus is transmitted. Again, on the other side, with the vaccine progress, Britain's medical regulator approved the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine, and it's going to be the first country to give the green light to the drug. Britain plans to roll out some 800,000 doses of the vaccine before the end of the year. So we have bad news and we have good news. Linda, I want to start with you. Nearly 37,000 Americans died of COVID-19 in November, the most in any month since the early days of the pandemic. What is the current president, the current administration, doing about it?
That's a really good question. I mean, here's an example. The White House is having a bunch of Christmas parties, as is the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. The health authorities of the U.S. government are telling people to not have gatherings outside a few immediate families. Stay within your household. Don't have a big Christmas family reunion. And yet the president and other top people in his administration are having parties. They're not wearing masks. It's just a continuation of this president's inability to model proper behavior during a very tragic time, which we're being told as we head into winter is going to be a very dark winter in all ways.
Jonathan, moving to the economic side of this, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell rejected a $908 billion stimulus plan, but he also insists that there must be a plan passed before the end of the new year. Will this stimulus package, this economic package of relief for Americans, happen before the end of the year? And what needs to change to put the tumblers in place to make that occur?
I can't say whether something will pass. Given the seriousness of the crisis, one would think that members of Congress wouldn't want to go home for the Christmas holiday before they've passed some relief measure, because all of this aid that the government has provided so far is going to run out at the end of the year. And a lot of people are going to be in very, very dire economic circumstances. So one would think that given the political pressure that they will do something, and I hope they do. However, the Democrats and Republicans are very, very far apart on the actual number of dollars that they want to appropriate. It began with the Democrats wanting something like $2 trillion and the Republicans offering $500 billion. Now it's the Democrats have come down to $908 billion, so almost a trillion, and the Republicans are sticking with their $500 billion figure. So it's really just a matter of negotiation at this point. But the problem is that there's not a lot of time. These kind of negotiations usually take some time, and the big question mark is whether they can get it done before December 11th, which is when they all leave to go home.
Linda, I'm going to go to you on this one. The vaccines are coming out. Vaccines are being rolled out already, approved and being rolled out in Great Britain. Vaccines are on the horizon in the United States, but not ready yet. And we still have an immediate health crisis that requires mask wearing and social distancing. Every health official has said that. My question is this. The U.S., in my humble estimation, failed in terms of tracking, testing, and PPE production early on and throughout the great majority of this pandemic situation. What needs to change so that it can succeed with the production of the vaccine and the distribution of the vaccine going forward?
What we need is everybody to put their partisan hats off to the side and do what makes sense in terms of logistics, supply chain management, get the best people in there. We're about to have a new administration. I think Joe Biden will put the very best people on this task. It's his top priority coming in. And then they need, on top of that, there are a significant portion of the American public who are anti-vaccination. A lot of them tend to be Trump supporters. They think vaccines cause other problems and aren't willing to do that. We need to reach herd immunity. We need a significant portion of the public to take the vaccine. And I will bring up one happy point, which is that three former U.S. presidents, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, have all offered to take the coronavirus vaccine on camera to promote confidence in its safety. I'm not sure they'll convince everybody, but just having that visual demonstration of three very prominent Americans, I think it can't help but be helpful.
It reminds me of a comment that that official from Georgia made that I mentioned earlier in the show, let those in positions of leadership show it. And I think that's a great display of leadership, sorely needed in these times. I want to take us to the Iran situation. Members of Iran's parliament were chanting death to Israel after meeting to discuss the killing Friday of the country's top nuclear scientist. This from the New York Times. Iran responded Wednesday to this assassination of its top nuclear scientist by enacting a law ordering an immediate ramping up of its enrichment of uranium to levels closer to weapons-grade fuel. And the measure also requires the expulsion of international nuclear inspectors if American sanctions are not lifted by early February, posing a direct challenge to President-elect Joseph R. Biden. Jonathan, you have much experience in this area. Let's talk first about responsibility for the assassination. Is it confirmed that Israel is responsible, and is Israel claiming responsibility?
Israel has not commented at all about this assassination. Apparently, a U.S. official, intelligence official, has said that Israel was responsible, and that's quite logical. Israel has killed about five other Iranian nuclear scientists between the years 2010 and 2012. So this top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was definitely on a list of the Israelis for targeted killing. The question here is about the timing. Some people feel that it was a message to Biden to complicate his desire and efforts to get back into the Iran nuclear deal as soon as he takes office. The Israelis don't like that deal. They never liked it. And they are trying to complicate his diplomacy to get back into that deal. Another explanation is that the Israelis have a list of things that they want to accomplish in terms of hurting Iran and hurting its nuclear program. And they feel that once Biden comes into office with more of an outreach to Iran and less of a hostile approach like the Trump administration has toward Iran, that it would be more difficult for Israel to actually carry out these things. So they want to get this stuff done quickly and within the short time period that they have before Biden takes office.
Lynn, I'll look to you for the last word. Your thoughts on how this particular incident and this situation complicates matters for the incoming foreign policy team in the Biden administration?
Well, I think Jonathan explained it all beautifully. And I will add that the Trump administration has been trying to tie the incoming Biden administration's hands on a number of fronts. And on Iran, they've piled on more sanctions. They just don't want Joe Biden to do a lot of things that he wants to do. And most outgoing administrations want a smooth transition.
Michael, if I could just add one thing. You mentioned the Iranian parliament's passage of this law. It's important to know that the nuclear program in Iran does not come under the jurisdiction of parliament or anybody but the supreme leader. So in a way, this law that they passed is almost the equivalent of a non-binding resolution in our Congress, where you get a sense of the Senate or a sense of the House expressing their feelings about an issue, but the resolution that they pass is not legally binding. That would be the equivalent in this case in Iran.
Well, that's a very important distinction, and thank you for making that. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have. So grateful for your insight and commentary. Thanks so much to our panelists, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Jonathan Broder, Contributing Editor for Congressional Quarterly. This program is produced by the Voice of America, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and Anna Mateo. Later, Greg Stockel and Jill Robbins answer a question from an English learner in Colombia. We close our program with an American story. This week, it is The Outcasts of Poker Flat. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
China recently landed its third spacecraft on the moon and says the Explorer vehicle successfully collected material from the lunar surface. The effort marks the first time in more than 40 years that any nation has collected samples from the moon for return to Earth. Observers believe the latest space mission, along with several others planned for the future, can help strengthen the image of China's ruling Communist Party. China is a generation behind the United States and Russia in its space exploration efforts. But its secretive military-linked space program is quickly developing. Among its space projects are a robot explorer on the way to Mars, development of a reusable space plane, and a planned human mission to the moon. Kathleen Campbell is an astrobiologist and geologist at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. She told the Associated Press that the next 10 years will be quite critical in space exploration. This is where we're going to transform out of near-Earth orbit and back into what people will call deep space, Campbell said. In 2003, China became the third nation to launch an astronaut into orbit on its own. It took place more than 40 years after the former Soviet Union and the United States launched astronauts into orbit. China's first orbiting laboratory was launched in 2011. A second was launched in 2016. Plans call for a permanent space station to be established after 2022. The latest moon landing represented a historic step in China's cooperation with the international community in the peaceful use of outer space, a foreign ministry spokeswoman said. The spokeswoman added, China will continue to support international cooperation and the exploration and use of outer space in the spirit of working for the benefit of all mankind. After astronaut Yang Li Wei's 2003 flight, Chinese space officials expressed hope for a crewed mission to the moon as early as 2020. They later pushed back that target to at least 2024. China's space plane would be its version of the American space shuttle and the former Soviet Union's short-lived Buran space plane. China also has launched its own network of GPS satellites, so its military does not need to depend on GPS systems operated by the U.S. or Russia. China's military-run space program is more secretive than those of other governments. Yang and other Chinese astronauts made very few public appearances after their flights. This compares to Soviet and American astronauts who were sent on publicity trips to visit huge crowds around the world. I'm Brian Lin.
It is not surprising that people have turned to TikTok for 60 seconds of relief in a year marked by the COVID-19 health crisis and social and political unrest. This week, the social media app shared its list of top 100 videos in America. The videos include a man skateboarding, singing, and drinking cranberry juice on his way to work. The director of creator community at TikTok is Kudzi Chikumbu. He told the Associated Press that there is a main idea, or through line, connecting all these videos. He said the through line is that these are videos that brought joy and inspiration to millions of Americans in a year that has been a bit of a whirlwind for everyone as we all try to figure it out. A whirlwind is a time filled with quickly changing events and feelings. TikTok is especially popular among younger people born between 1981 to 2012. They experiment with effects like green screens to add different backdrops. Some have even become social media stars called influencers with many followers. The Weeknd's Blinding Lights and Jason Derulo's Savage Love inspired TikTok dance challenges that made them the top songs on the app. For some TikTok creators, the coronavirus itself became inspiration to create a connection with other users. Caitlin Riley used the app to make fun of coworkers on Zoom. It became one of the top liked videos. Curtis Roach sang about endless days at home with his song, Bored in the House. Something people all over the world can relate to. The second most popular video was made by an Idaho man named Nathan Apodaca. He became famous with a video of himself singing Dreams by Fleetwood Mac while skateboarding on a road. When talking about Apodaca's video, Chikumbu said, "It's really about capturing an essence and a moment." However, for those who have not used the app, some of the videos may be hard to understand, including the most liked TikTok video. In the video, Bella Porch, a woman with 45 million followers, simply moved her mouth or lip-synced to the words of a song. She added a few seconds of well-timed head moving and eye rolling. She has since launched her own businesses and turned her art form into a career. The app might be aimed at younger people. However, Chikumbu said this year the growth of TikTok has pushed it more into popular culture. He said, "You're seeing everyone, from the teenager to the college student, with their parents and their grandparents, all making videos. Some of the most watched videos show people's homes. Others show people making things like donuts. All signs of the times. I'm Ana Mateo.
Today, we answer a question from Jorge in Colombia. He writes, I'd like to know the difference between how long and how much time. When should I use them? Thank you. From Jorge in Colombia. Dear Jorge, thank you for your question. Both how long and how much time are used to ask about the amount of time something takes or has taken. But there are differences between the two. Let us take a look at them.
You will probably hear how long more than how much time. It can sound less formal than how much time, and many speakers find it more natural. It often comes at the beginning of a question. Here are a few examples.
How long have you lived in Texas? How long will you be at the store?
How long is often used with the present perfect verb tense. So the questions you may want to ask will likely begin with how long have you? English speakers do not use how long directly before the word time. It is not correct to say how long time. However, you may hear how long a time in some situations, as in this example.
How long a time will we have to wait for the test result? How much time is more exact than how long? You will hear it at the beginning of a question. It is often used when asking about a shorter length of time. English speakers may think it sounds a bit awkward to say how much time when not asking for or giving directions. For example, you might use how much time to ask for the amount of time it takes to cook something. Or you might use how much time to ask for the estimated length of time it takes to do a task.
How much time does it take to cook rice? How much time will it take to clean the house? Thank you for the question, Jorge. I hope it did not take too much time for you to understand the answer. And that's Ask a Teacher. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Greg Stockel.
Now, an American story from the Voice of America. We present The Outcasts of Poker Flat by Bret Hart. Here is Jim Tedder.
John Oakhurst was a gambler. He had lived in the small western town of Poker Flat for only a short time. He had defeated many people at cards. He had also won a lot of their money. For that reason alone, he was not well liked. On the morning of November 23rd, 1850, he saw some men talking as he walked down the main street of the town. As he came near, they got quiet. He said to himself, I guess they're talking about me, and that can't be good. Oakhurst was right. Some of the town's leaders had met secretly and decided to force some people to leave. They thought Poker Flat would be a better place to live if those people were gone. Besides Oakhurst, two women of low morals were led to the edge of town. They were the Duchess, as she was called, and Mother Shipton. A man called Uncle Billy was added to the group. He was known to drink too much. Some people thought that he had also stolen some gold. They had no proof, but that did not matter. Uncle Billy was just no good, and he had to go. The outcasts were told that if they ever came back, they would be killed. So the four of them slowly rode out of town. The Duchess cried and said she would probably die on the road. Mother Shipton and Uncle Billy cursed.
Damn it.
Mother said she would like to cut the heart out of the people who had done this to them. But John Oakhurst rode in silence. He thought all of life was a gamble. He had just run into some bad luck. That was all. The outcasts were headed for Sandy Bar, a camp not too far away. But it was high up in the cold Sierra Mountains, and the path was anything but smooth. Around noon, Mother Shipton became so tired, she fell off her horse. She said that was as far as she was going today. Oakhurst tried to make them move on because they had no food or fuel. But the three would not listen. Instead, they began to drink alcohol that Uncle Billy had hidden. Soon, they were quiet and asleep. Oakhurst did not drink. He stood nearby and watched them. He began to think about his life and about how lonely he was. Yet he was stronger than his three companions. He could have left them there and set off alone, but he did not. Then he heard someone call,
John Oakhurst.
A young man named Tom Simpson came riding up. The gambler knew Tom. They had once played cards, and Oakhurst had won. But after the game, he told young Tom that he was too easy to beat, and he gave him back his money. Tom said Oakhurst would be his friend for life. Tom was not alone. From behind a tree came his new wife, a girl named Piney Woods. Her father had not wanted her to marry Tom, so they had run away. Tom told Oakhurst that he had a little food. He also showed him an old log house just off the path. Years of harsh weather had nearly ruined it. But it was all they had, and it would have to do. The women could spend the night in there. The men would make a fire and sleep on the ground by the door. The night seemed to pass quickly, but the weather became colder. The wind increased, and it began to snow. Oakhurst had a bad feeling. He turned to where Uncle Billy had slept and found him gone. He had left the others and even taken their horses. Oakhurst said Uncle Billy had probably gone for help, but he knew better. The group of five decided to wait for the snow to stop before traveling farther. They no longer had horses. From here on, they would be on foot. By the third day out from Poker Flat, the snow had gotten deep. They could no longer see the path. Food was running low. Everything around them was white and cold. 1 week later, they still had not moved. The snow was deeper than ever, and it continued to fall. It formed a prison they could not escape. Still, they could see smoke rising from the warm fires in the houses down below in Poker Flat. The sight seemed especially cruel. But the little group of outcasts tried to keep up their spirits. They tried to stay as warm as they could. They sat together by their own open-air fire, and Tom Simpson pulled out a small accordion from his pack. Piney Woods played the instrument. They all sang songs. The music took on a defiant quality, a quality of resistance. But the outcasts had to listen to the sad cries of their mostly empty stomachs. The hunger got worse with each passing day. At midnight on the 10th day, Mother Shipton called Oakhurst to her side. She said, "Give this to the young ones." In a bag was all her food. She had not eaten for days. She had saved the food for the others. She turned quietly to the wall of the log house and died. John Oakhurst began to think that none of them would live out the storm. He gave Tom Simpson a pair of snowshoes and asked him to try to walk back to Poker Flat for help. He guessed it would take Tom at least 2 days, if not more, to get there. Tom kissed his new bride and left on foot. Soon, he was out of sight. The Duchess and Piney were surprised and frightened when Oakhurst also turned to leave. "You're not going too," they cried. He said, "Only a little way. I need to find us some help." At that time of year, daylight did not last long. When night came, Oakhurst had not returned. The two women were too hungry, weak, and cold to even add more wood to the fire. They passed the stormy night holding each other close. And that is the way they were found the next morning when help arrived from Poker Flat. They had frozen to death during the night. The rescuers from town said that they had been right to force the outcasts to leave Poker Flat. But they never thought the punishment would end up like this. Justice was one thing, but freezing people to death was not their aim. And then they thought of the gambler. Where was he? What had happened to him? They searched as best they could. And then they found him. Under a tall tree, a playing card was stuck into the wood by a knife. On the card was written, "Beneath this tree lies the body of John Oakhurst, who had some bad luck starting the 23rd of November, 1850. He handed in his cards on the 7th of December, the same year. Oakhurst sat there, cold and still. They said he looked peaceful. A single bullet from a small handgun nearby had ended his life. John Oakhurst had been both the strongest and the weakest of the outcasts of Poker Flat.
You have been listening to An American Story on the Voice of America. The Outcasts of Poker Flat by Bret Hart was adapted and read by Jim Tedder. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.